Welcome to Headlines. This week, our guest will be the esteemed Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, Executive Vice President of the Venerable Agudas Yisrael of America. Rabbi Zwiebel is an attorney by training. He also has the distinguished President Reagan appointee on the National Commission of Children. He was also appointed by Condoleezza Rice as to the U.S. Delegation for Security and Cooperation of Anti-Semitism and Intolerance. The following week, we will have Rabbi Chaim Jachter, author of numerous svarim. He'll be speaking about the crisis with mamzerim due to the lack of, you know, valid gittin, etc. in our society. The next week, we will have a guest from Eretz Yisrael, from Israel, the famed Rabbi Usher Weiss, the author of the Minchas Usher, which is found in most shuls, many homes have it, but certainly one of the most, you know, prominent paiskim in Eretz Yisrael will be the following week. You can listen to us on WMCA 570 or at WMCA.com. That's with the Zev Brenner Network, or at NachumSiegel.com. If you have questions, you can email us at questions@headlinesbook.com. In general, if there are any topics you'd like us to discuss or any particular guests, you can email us at either questions@headlines.com or at info@headlinesbook.com. Before we begin this program, I would like to dedicate it. I'd like to do a dedication this week to somebody very unusual. And that is a fascinating figure who lived almost 2,000 years ago, actually 1,800 years ago, and his name was Rav Iddi, and he was a hero of mine. And let me tell you the story of Rav Iddi. Rav Iddi lived someplace either in Iraq or Egypt, we're not exactly sure, but he wanted to attend the great school, the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, run by Rabbi Yochanan. But it was 3 months of travel in each direction. Imagine that in those days, how unsafe travel was. And I doubt if his camel had air conditioning. So he used to leave right after Pesach, travel for 3 months through the desert or through the mountains, arrive in Eretz Yisrael. He studied for 1 day. And then he would have to travel back 3 months to be able to be home for the Chag, for the holiday of Sukkot. So he traveled 6 months to study for 1 day. It's a Gemara in Chagig on Hey Amid Beis. Now, why am I talking about Rav Iddi? Because this week, if you do the calculation, is sort of the equicenter between Pesach and Sukkot, which means this is the week, and perhaps today is the day, according to my calculation, today is the day, the exact equicenter, when Rav Iddi studied in yeshiva. So I say, this one's for you, Rav Iddi, a man who traveled for 6 months. And the Gemara says that originally they mocked him, and Rabbi Yochanan got very scared, and he said, "B'matusa minach, I beg of you," he was worried about Rav Iddi's kepeda, that he would be humbled or embarrassed, humiliated by the chachamim, all the wise people in the yeshiva mocking him, a person who shows up for 1 day in yeshiva. And Rav Yochanan darshened, "I see yom yom yidrashen." He says, 1 day of study that was done for the right reasons has the same value of study of an entire year. If a person prepares for 6 months for one moment, it's as if he studied the entire time. It's as if he did good the entire time. Now, this is even more relevant because the Marsha learns a little bit different. The Marsha says, actually, that Rav Iddi used to leave his home to go to work. And he says, in those days, it wasn't like today, they didn't have planes and they didn't have, you know, good highways. He said he would have to travel for 3 months to go to work. And during that entire 3 month period, he had actually no time to study, to learn. So he would take off at every 3 months 1 day to learn. And that 1 day that he would go to yeshiva during those 3 months, it was as if he learned an entire year. And that's very relevant because a lot of us don't have the luxury of, you know, spending all day to do the things we would like to do. You know, we may not be supported by others or want to live off of charity. So we work very, very hard. And many times we say, we wish we could spend more time doing the right thing. But Rav Iddi says, all that preparatory time is what counts. Now, here's something very different. On Wall Street, in most corporeal matters, intent doesn't matter. All that matters is results. There was an article this week, an op-ed in the New York Times, that talks about all those horrible masters of the universe. And it talks about a number of great, you know, heroes, titans in Wall Street today, or in Eastern America today, you know, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, and it talks about them, and it says, like, how one of them, who was a billionaire many, many times over, his secretary asked him for a raise. And he said, let me think about that. Why don't you take 2 weeks of vacation while I do that? And this had been his personal admin for 12 years, according to the Times. And when she came back from a two-week vacation, he said, you know, I thought about it, and rather than a raise, I think a termination is more in order. I'm firing you. And Steve Jobs was famous when he would get into the elevator. If he didn't like the way somebody looked in the elevator, he would terminate them. He would just say, you're fired, and walk out of the elevator. Elon Musk of Tesla, who's like an icon in America today, he divorced his wife with 5 children. And she posted a letter on the internet that after they were married and they had met in school, he had her sign something, and she wasn't too smart, and she did. And it basically gave him all rights. She had no rights to his estate, to anything he earned. And she said, I was married to one of the wealthiest men in the world, and I have 5 children from him. But in the divorce, I couldn't even get the money for a house, so I live in a rented apartment. All I want is a house for my children. How could it be in the court system today, one of the wealthiest men in the world can divorce his wife, who he married out of school when he had nothing, and not give her the money for a house? She writes this letter. It's on the internet. So this is in America, but we don't care. We care about results. But in Dvarim Ruchniyim, in spiritual matters, we see it's not like that. It's not results that counts, but it's really intent that matters. And it's not just in religion or in spirituality. It's in relationships, too. Think of it, the man who comes home and is wealthy and gives his wife, you know, with a sour face, some expensive gift. And then you have the person who maybe bought a rose, but he worked hard to come up with that extra few dollars. Where is there more ahava? Let me share a story with you. So this family is having, you know, the 25th anniversary for the parents. And they have a number of children, and they have a son who's already 23, and he has a wonderful job, and he's making money. And they have, all the way down, they have a little daughter who's 4 years old. So for the 25th anniversary, the kids decide they're making a surprise anniversary appearance, party for the parents. And they make a party, and they prepare everything. And the 23-year-old who's making good money goes out, and he buys some beautiful gift for the father. And, you know, the 19-year-old, from his allowance, buys something beautiful. Now, the 3-year-old little girl, she doesn't get any allowance, and she's feeling a little left out. And the other kids see her, and she's busy, and she's wrapping up something with paper and wrapping and writing and wrapping. And the parents come, and the father opens up, and he's beautiful. What is it? It's a beautiful crystal bowl from the oldest child. And the second one, it's a set of his and her watches. And then the little girl's wrapped, carefully wrapped box, he takes off paper, and inside there's a little box. And the whole family's wondering, why did she buy? She has no money. So the father takes the scotch tape off from around the box, and he opens up the box, and inside the box there is nothing. So he looks at his little daughter and he says, sweetie, what did you give me? And she looks at her parents and she says, oh, don't you see? I filled the box with kisses. Now I ask you, which gift do you think was appreciated more? So Rev Iddi told us, 6 months, one day, it's the intent. He traveled so hard. It meant so much to him. So to all of us, all of you out there who work so hard for that one moment that you can do the right thing, I say, Rev Iddi, you lived 1,800 years ago. This program is for you today. We have with us the esteemed Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, the Executive Vice President of the Venerable Agudas Yisrael. He's an attorney by trade. He's also received the President, he's also a President Reagan appointee to the National Commission on Children. Condoleezza Rice appointed him to the U.S. Delegation for Security regarding anti-Semitism and intolerance. It's an honor to have you with us, Rabbi Zwiebel.
Thank you so very much, Rabbi.
So one of the topics in the forefront of the news for the last, I would say, number of years has been metzitza bepeh, which is oral suction done during a bris milah. And the Aguda has clearly come out in favor of it and has, you know, tried to work out all kinds of compromises with the local, with the city government, etc. Could you give us a little background on that?
Sure. And just to clarify, it's not so much that Aguda has come out in favor of the practice of metzitza bepeh, which is actually something that's the subject of different minhagim in Klal Yisrael, different mesiris, different hairois by different gedolei aposkim, and different communities follow different traditions in this respect. There are many who, for whom the metzitza that that is required can be accomplished and is accomplished through a little glass pipe, and to them that's a lachatzchila. It's not a bidyevet, and many within the constituency of Agudas Yisrael, as a matter of fact, would hold to that halachic opinion and halachic mesira through their particular communities. But then there are others, many others, for whom metzitza bepeh must be done directly through oral suction, directly with the mouth, and not through any intermediary keli. And for them, that is part and parcel of the mitzvah of bris milah. So our role as a national umbrella-type organization that tries to bring in all the different factions of Klal Yisrael and to fight to preserve the rights of all different factions of Klal Yisrael, when there were issues regarding the possibility of banning the practice of bris milah, of metzitza bepeh, or regulating it in significant ways, which could have had a severe impact on that section of the community that does observe metzitza bepeh as an integral part of the mitzvah, that's something which our gedolim, including those gedolim, by the way, who personally in their own mesira is not to do metzitza directly bepeh, but through a keli. But all of the gedolim who sit at the table of the Mu'etzes Gedolei HaTorah felt that this was an issue that impacted Klal Yisrael. Certainly that portion, that very significant portion of Klal Yisrael that holds that metzitza bepeh is an integral part of the mitzvah of bris milah. And then even beyond that, when Mayor Bloomberg in New York City worked toward a regulation that would have in some small way regulated the practice of metzitza bepeh, this represented the very first time in the history of the United States that a governmental body had taken an action to regulate an aspect of bris milah. And given the climate of what we see going on all across the globe, here in the United States, there was a ballot referendum initially set to be put before the voters in San Francisco that would have said that circumcision, not metzitza bepeh, circumcision could not be performed on a minor, and that only when a person had reached the age of majority, meaning 18 years old, could he then decide on his own to have himself circumcised. In other countries around the world, there have been a number of efforts to restrict the practice of bris milah itself. There is a growing no-circ movement, so to say, no circumcision, which is pressing governmental bodies to prohibit or very severely limit the practice of circumcision. So given that climate, our gedolim felt that it was very important that at the very first sign of a governmental encroachment upon what had been understood all these years to be sacrosanct. The government couldn't start up with an essential religious practice like bris milah, but here, for the very first time, Mayor Bloomberg did that, and they felt that that was something which had to be resisted, and we had to send the message that bris milah is sacrosanct. It cannot be interfered with or regulated by government, whatever internal measures we need to take as a community to make sure that bris milah is done in as safe and sanitary a fashion as is possible. Those are steps that we should be taking internally. But once government starts imposing its will upon a mitzvah like this, that's a very dangerous step. So we joined together, the Aguda, together with the Satmar community, together with the Chabad community, and challenged Mayor Bloomberg's regulation of the practice of mitzvah peh. Actually, at the U.S. Court of Appeals won a very significant victory in this case, and now Mayor de Blasio has taken the initial steps towards having this regulation removed. So that's the long-winded response to your question, Rav David, but I hope it will give your listeners a sense of why we felt that this was such an important matter to take on, and why we are so pleased that, in fact, the current mayor of New York City, the current incumbent, de Blasio, has agreed to take steps that would remove the city from its role as regulator of an aspect of this very chashuva mitzvah.
So let me ask you a question, Rabbi Zwiebel. How would you explain to a secular person, there have been, and I don't really want, I don't think we should get into whether it's true or not, but there have been a number of, medical papers published that say that there have been 11 cases of neonatal herpes, or 17 cases, or 24 cases, whatever the number is, and endangered the lives of the children, right? And we're taking the position as a community, well, we have a right to bris mila, and even though it endangers, don't, constrict religious values. How would you juxtapose that with, let's say, for example, others who say we can't give our agunis gittin, and therefore some people, wrongfully went ahead and beat up people to be able to allow for a get. So clearly the rule of law at some point has to be willing to step forward and say, look, notwithstanding religious values, there has to be law. So we have a law, protect your children from, what could be seen in their eyes as dangerous practices. And in this case, it's allow for, people to get their get, which l'halacha, assuming that they were right, you can be kaifa in certain instances, which clearly here, by the way, in the past cases were not the case. You can be kaifa get. What is the right? How would you try to explain where the government does have a right to restrict behavior and where should the government say hands-off policy?
Well, it's a very good question, and it's a very broad question, obviously. Without going into the situation of Aguna, we do need to be very careful in terms of how we deal with the Aguna situations, both in terms of asking the government to help us deal with the Aguna problem, which has been the subject of some discussion and action over the last several decades. There have been a couple of laws passed in New York State, for example, where the government has taken a step designed to get at the Aguna problem, to encourage recalcitrant spouses to give their wives gittin. Those laws themselves have encountered some controversy, at least one of those laws. So asking government to be helpful in dealing with the Aguna situation, or recognizing that government has the authority and the power to step in to prevent certain steps of kfiya that you mentioned, which could lead to a resolution of some Aguna situations, at least. It's a very delicate balance, and there are a lot of complicated halachic questions as well as legal questions that are raised by all of that. But just returning for a moment to Matzitza Bapeh, there was in this litigation that I mentioned earlier, in the court papers that were presented, there were affidavits from experts really on both sides of the question. There were a number of medical experts who came in on the side of the city and took the position that, in fact, the action of the Matzitza Bapeh has led to a number of cases over the last number of years of herpes infection in children. There were experts on the other side of the equation who came in and said that the evidence has not been established definitively. And this remains a subject of some controversy within the medical community right now. What we noted in our briefs is that, putting aside the question of whether the city is right or wrong in its assessment of the level of risk involved in the Tzitzibapeh, number one, that level of risk, even according to the city's figures, is very, very, very low, Baruch Hashem. And number two, if you look at other types of activities that go on and that are unregulated in the city, even those involving minors, let's take the example that I like to use of high school football. There are many injuries, and some of them quite serious, actually, that young children, I mean teenagers, suffer when they play high school football. And
can I interrupt you for a minute?
Please.
According to Stanford Children's Health, that's www.stanfordchildrens.org, 215,000 children between the ages of 5 to 14 are treated in the hospital emergency room for football-related injuries annually.
Yeah, there you go. So, there are certain things that society would never start up with. We can't start up with football, right? We can't start up with football. That's as American as apple pie and all the other great things. And today, football is probably a lot more American than apple pie is. So you can't start up with that, despite the fact that we as a society know that this practice, football is something which is quite a higher level of danger and risk, certainly, than any possibility of infection transmitted through Mitzitzibapeh. So, when society picks and chooses which types of activities it wants to regulate and those that it chooses not to regulate, it's making a value judgment. That there's something about football that is so essential to our community and our society, we're not going to start up with that. But on the other hand, when it comes to bris milah, we understand that some, old-fashioned Jews insist on doing this practice as part of their religious ritual, but we know better, and this is not that important to us, and therefore we're going to take steps to try and eradicate that practice.
So let me just ask again. So let me just point out Rabbi Zwiebel. By the way, we're speaking to Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, Executive Vice President of Agudas Yisrael. Listen to this statistic. 3.5 million children, this is again from Stanford Children's Health, available online. You can look it up. Sports Injury Statistics. 3.5 million children, 14 and younger, which is, when you consider the amount of children in the country, 14 and younger, represents a staggeringly high number, get hurt annually playing sports. 21% of all traumatic brain injuries among American children are from sports activities. It's a staggering number, 21. So can I ask you a question? Do you believe that if 3.5 million children annually are getting injured, and 21% seriously injured with traumatic brain injury, would you think it's fair to say that the 11 children who've contacted herpes, assuming that their report is correct, or if it's 21, it's 21, this has created, I think there were 11 New York Times articles on this topic. Is it possible that there's 11 children with numerous New York Times front page articles, 3.5 million children, no New York Times articles? Is it possible that maybe just a little bit we're being picked on over here?
Well, I can't imagine why anybody might think that, but you make a very compelling case of that. But I do want to mention that I think it's important for us as a community not to in any way try to minimize the seriousness of the concerns that have been raised. We ourselves as a community would be very well served if we would know the facts. I mentioned before that there is a difference within the medical community. The experts that we produced in the litigation did not say with certainty that Mitzitzibapeh has never ever caused the transmission of an infection, of a herpes infection, from the male to the child. They can't say that with certainty. There are ways of determining with greater certainty through DNA testing, which has started to happen in Rockland County, and which we hope will happen in New York City as well, to establish more definitively what the source of a child's herpes infection might be, whether there is a direct connection to the myo or not, or maybe it was a different caregiver who might have transmitted, or who knows what. But it's important for us to get this information. It's important for our Rabbanim to study this information. It's certainly important for us to develop a set of best practices for our Mayalim to make sure that Mayalim are taking whatever possible steps they can take to minimize the very slim risk that may exist of transmission of an infection. Obviously, our children are our most precious resource, and we have to take every possible step we can and study the medical facts and learn how to do things a little bit better so that whatever minimal slight risk there may be of transmission would be minimized even further still.
Just in conclusion to this topic, Rabbi Zibel, I would postulate that the difference between this and, let's say, you know, the government interference, the trial is just going on, we got in reference to Agunas, is that nobody's breaking any laws by doing mitzitza bepeh. There is no law against oral suction. There is a law against beating up strangers.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly, halachically, or legally, we are doing nothing wrong. Government is trying to superimpose itself where it shouldn't be. Whereas in these other cases, government is actually just saying, look, it's a law on the books and you're violating what is an existent law.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right on that distinction, but that distinction may no longer be valid a year from now or 10 years from now if some of the opponents of Mitzitza B'Peh have their way, because there definitely has been a movement in some quarters to outright ban the practice. And I can't imagine that our government would do that here in the United States at any time in the foreseeable future, but without question there is agitation toward that goal, and that's one of the things that we have to be extremely vigilant about. And as I said, because once we start with regulation of any aspect of bris milah, even if we're part of a community that doesn't insist that mitzitza be done bepeh directly through direct oral suction, but we have to recognize, I believe, that bris milah must be kept sacrosanct, out of the hands of governmental regulation and government and officials who would like us to tell us how to do the mitzvah. That's something we have to, I think, resist as powerfully as we possibly can.
So I'd just like to give a little background into the halachic issues with mitzitza b'peh, oral suction. And really, it's a Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel 133. The Gemara says that you do mitzitza, you do oral suction on Shabbos. So the Gemara says on the next page, 133b, the Gemara says that a male who does not do mitzitza b'peh, you remove him. The Gemara says, Amar of Papa, hai umna devoy mayet sakanahu the abrinale, a male who does not do oral suction, it's a sakana, it's dangerous for the child, and you remove him. And the Gemara says, it's pashut. Why? If you see that you mechal Shabbos for it, you're allowed to do mitzitza, which is chabura. On Shabbos, you see that it's a sakana. So the Gemara says clearly the entire purpose of mitzitza is only because it's a sakana, because it's a danger for the child, and not because it's part of the milah. Because if it was actually part of the milah, the Gemara would say you should remove this male not because of sakana, but you should remove him because he's doing it incorrectly. Would you say that a shochet who shechts with a hacksaw would shecht them because it's a sakana? You wouldn't say that. You would say because he's not doing it properly. So the Gemara is saying it's not part of the milah. It's only because of sakana. Which really, honestly, whoever says that it's me'ikar adin or a deraisa, it's climbing uphill. It's against the Beferish Gemara. And same thing in the Rambam, Shulchan Aruch. It's all because of sakana. Now, the Chassam Sofer, there's a Tshuva Chassam Sofer that is not printed in the Tshuvas, but it's from the year Tavkuf Tzadik Zayin, which would be 1837, and was written to a Talmud of his, a student of his, who was the rabbi of Vienna. And he said in Vienna there was an outbreak of children. His name was Rebbe Eliezer Halevi Horowitz. And many children were dying because they got infected from mitzitza b'peh. And Chassam Sofer, in a lengthy tshuva, writes that, so stop it. In a short tshuva, he says the entire reason for it is because It's for refuah reasons, and if it's not causing the refuah, so stop doing it. So, the Chasam Sof is the first to opine openly, and which doesn't seem like much of a, you know, chiddush when it's an open Gemara, but here's where it gets very interesting. The Maharam Shik, who was arguably one of the, you know, two or three greatest Talmidim of the Chasam Sof, writes in a tshuva, and it's in Archaim 152, he writes that Metzitza Bepeh is ma'akev in the Mila. He says it's essential part of the Mila. And he did not have, it seems, this letter from the Chasam Sof. Now, based on this, a number of people over the generations have said that the first letter from the Chasam Sof, which was printed 100 years ago, 150 years ago, must have been a forgery. Which is rather, you know, a little macabre, but that's what they say. But here's what I would opine, and this is what my guess would be. The Maharam Shik wrote his tshuva right around when the reform movement came out and wanted to abolish Mila. So at that point, touching any part of Mila was sacrosanct. It was like a very slippery slope. You're going to tangle with Metzitza Bepeh and the Amoratzim and the reform movement. The next thing they're going to say is, oh, so you see all Mila is now disposable. So it's possible that that's the reason there was such a hisnagdus to any change in Metzitza Bepeh post-reform when they tried to make, you know, very critical changes. And I have no proof of this. I'm just saying a possibility. But what is this based on? Because you can't say that the Chasam Sof is a forgery, and I'll tell you why. Because if you look in Chidushei Chasam Sof, that's what he writes on Gemara in Shabbos, and this is on Daf Kuvav Amar Aleph, the Chasam Sof clears a very interesting question. And the Chasam Sof's question is like this. He says, Mila is Deicha Shabbos. You're allowed to be Mael on Shabbos, even though it's Maitzi Dam, so it's an Issa Deraisa of Chabur. You're allowed to do it on Shabbos. But then he asks the most interesting question. He says, the Metzitza, why is that Deicha Shabbos? That's another Issa. He says, so why not do the Mila on Shabbos and do the Metzitza, do it right by Shkia, and do the Metzitza after Shkia, Shabbos, Matzah Shabbos, in effect, so that way you're not over the Issa Chabura of Metzitza. So clearly he held Metzitza is not part of the actual, Chelik of Mila, Maisa Mila, because just like Himo Yimel says that Mila is Deicha Shabbos, the Metzitza would also be Deicha Shabbos. So it's very far-fetched to say that the Chasam Sof is a forgery, both in his letter and as well as in the Chidushei Chasam Sof, somebody came along and I didn't see anybody shtels to this Tshuva Chasam Sof, so it's very interesting. So this is a little bit of the background. So it's, even though there are, you know, I saw the Stechemid writes that it's halacha l'mayishim Sinai, it's really, you know, it's negative gemara. What can I tell you? You know, b'mkai me'munach is covered, but it is negative gemara. So, but I do 100% agree that it's certainly a minig of Klal Yisrael. So in our, you know, very esteemed Rabbi Zwiebel says that if it's a minig of Klal Yisrael, why should that be worse than a Jets game? Right, I mean that has to have, you know, it's a minig that goes back, you know, thousands of years. I mean, it's, you know, when your kid plays hockey dressed in some Ranger uniform and he can get a puck in his eye or get 21% of traumatic brain injury in the United States is from sports injuries, and this is children less than 14. I mean, are the 11 people who got ostensibly herpes through Mila, the million people who had Mila, I mean, isn't that somewhat silly? Isn't that really, you know, disproportionate focus? So let's return to our interview with Rabbi Zwiebel. We're speaking to the esteemed Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, the Executive Vice President of the most venerable Agudas Yisroels, at the forefront of protecting, defending, looking out for the, you know, the rights of not only the Orthodox community, but for, I think, most moral and religious communities here in the United States. I'd like to bring up a subject with you that's been hotly debated, and that is school vouchers. Mm-hmm. And I know that the Aguda has, been very pro school vouchers, which school vouchers are basically some type of a subsidy from either the local, some form of government, be it the local, the city, state, federal, etc., to a subsidy for private and secondary schools. Can you fill us in? What is the Aguda position on this before we start a discussion?
Sure. Going back to the times of Rav Aaron Kotler, who was who was the guiding light of so much of the policy that Agudath Yisrael adopted during the early years of Agudath Yisrael of America's activism and advocacy efforts. And Rav Aaron was the head of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah in that tekufa. And the question came up at that time whether or not Agudath Yisrael should support, or like most of the rest of the Jewish community, oppose efforts to get governmental assistance for parents who send their children to yeshivas. More generally, that would translate into governmental assistance for parents who send their children to non-public schools. Of whatever denomination or non-denomination, whatever it may be. And the large bulk of the Jewish community at that time was opposed to any form of governmental assistance. They insisted on a very strong barrier between church and state, between government and religion, and therefore, if you want to send your child to public school, wonderful, government will subsidize it, but if you want to send your child to a private religious school, the burden is all on your shoulders. Don't look to government to try to alleviate that in any way. And then there was another perspective, which ultimately was the perspective that Agudath Yisrael, under the direction of Rav Aaron and other Gedolei Yisrael at that time, took, which was that, well, parents are being taxed. They're using a non-public system, in our case, a yeshiva system, to educate their children. They're paying taxes to help support the public school system. Wouldn't it be fair that at least a little portion of those tax dollars be returned, in a sense, through assistance programs that would benefit yeshiva children? Yes, there is an important principle of separation between church and state, between government and religion, but there are ways to structure programs which are consistent with the Constitution, which do not violate that separation of church and state requirement, and through which our schools and our parents can benefit.
Is it possible that times have changed? And let me give you a counter argument.
Sure.
Okay. If you go to Wikipedia, and, you know, I just public information, okay, so they have an article on education in France. And England, which has also a very tolerant attitude, they supplement, they're called over there faith-based schools. Look what's happened to England. In the beginning, they were so excited, and now look what's happened with Tunisia, the homegrown terrorist, to say nothing about being a Jew in England. Do you know that in France, according to the Washington Post, 9%, this is an astonishing number, 9% of French Jews will emigrate this year, will flee from France. So I ask you a question. There are 181 countries in the world, right? North Korea, which 3 million people have died in gulag there from starvation, has been excoriated by there have been 2 UN resolutions against North Korea. There have been 70 against Israel. 3 million North Koreans die of starvation. 70, why? Because there's the Muslim bloc in the UN is 60 or 70 countries. Where do we go when we flee the United States? Which country are we going to next? And my question to you is it worth opening up, making this country friendly to school vouchers when there's 5 million a month of people who openly hate the American way of life, and the chance of being put on boats like the Lufthansa with nowhere to go because we want a few shekels in our pockets today? Or perhaps maybe another alternative is maybe re-examine our tzedakahs so that maybe we can be, you know, just support our schools and cut back in other areas, but not be looking with a boat with nowhere to go.
These are the kinds of difficult questions for which we're very happy that these kinds of questions are considered by and determined by Gedolei Yisrael. I'll tell you just something to support your point, David, and how important it is for us as a community to think about those kinds of things while at the same time recognizing how important it is for us to find ways to support our Moetzes HaTorah, our yeshivas. There was a particular possibility a number of years ago, about 10 years ago really, in New York, to pursue a particular form of governmental assistance to our yeshivas. And there was some controversy surrounding this program, and we presented the question to Gedolei Yisrael. The majority said that we should, in fact, pursue this. It would mean a lot to the community, and we did, and we were successful, Baruch Hashem. However, one of the Rosh Yeshiva said as follows, and this supports very much the general thought that you've expressed now. He says, yes, it is true that in the time of Rav Aaron Cutler and the other Gedolei Yisrael who arrived in America and rebuilt from nothing and created a remarkable infrastructure of Torah in this country, where there had been zero, where there had been almost a total midbar. At that time, it was necessary, perhaps, to say, we need every penny of support that we can find from whatever source we can find it. Let's ask the government to help us out. And that's why Klal Yisrael, for all these years, has been involved in seeking out governmental support for its institutions. But when you're talking about a major new program, like we were discussing then 10 years ago, and there are some issues surrounding this program and its suitability for our community. His expression was, "Bekoshi hitiru," only with difficulty were the Gedolei Yisrael matir that they encouraged the idea of asking government to be a supporter of our institutions. But now, at that time, we needed them. We couldn't do it on our own, he says. But today, Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has blessed Klal Yisrael with gevirim, with people who are Bali Tzedakah, with people who, if everybody would really put their heart to it and their mind to it, we could be self-sufficient for our yeshivas. Now, he's not suggesting, said this Rosh Yeshiva, that we should abandon all those programs that we were able to establish for the yeshiva community up until that point. But looking forward, he says, to bring in a major new program at this time is maybe we would instead say, this is going to bring in $20 million a year to our yeshivas. Let's find a way to raise $20 million a year through other sources. So it was a very interesting perspective. It didn't win the day. But the fact that this type of conversation takes place among Gedolei Yisrael, and that they do take note of the fact that here in the United States of America, the religious school community, by and large, has been dwindling. There have been fewer and fewer students in the Roman Catholic schools, which is the single largest source of non-public schooling in this country, and their numbers have been going down significantly. As a matter of fact, the numbers of all the denominations have been going down significantly in terms of their religious schools, with two exceptions, the Jewish school community and, you guessed it, the Muslim school community. Those are the two that have been showing upward trends. On the one hand, I think we ought to take tremendous pride in that. It is indeed true that the secret of whatever hatzlacha we have had in rebuilding from the ashes of Churban Europe here in America has been because we have built up a vibrant Jewish school community all across the country. And for the time being, at least, the Islamic schools are a relatively small proportion. And by the way, I can't tell you with certainty exactly what is taught at these Islamic schools, and some of them may be very much within the American mainstream, some of them may not. But the concern that you raise is obviously one that we have to monitor closely, and which may or may not cause us to reevaluate certain positions that we have long held.
We're speaking to Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel of the Agoda, the esteemed and eloquent spokesperson. Rabbi Zwiebel, I'd just like to, just one last thing. I don't want to beat this point to death, but here's another interesting statistic. More Muslims go to mosque in England than Christians go to church. Astonishing statistic. Now, I'd also like to point out, when Rabbi Aaron was alive, this was a non-existent issue. There weren't a billion and a half of them. They weren't spreading across the world. There wasn't ISIS. There wasn't Al-Qaeda. So times change. It says when Yaakov fought with the Suri Shel Esav, he asked him, "Ma shemecha?" Like, what's your name? I mean, what's your name? What did it matter what his name was? Beryl, Yossel, Yankel. Like, well, my nafgamina. But I think he was asking him is, I want to know what my enemy looks like. And he said, "Lama ze tikra l'shmei?" He says, "I can't tell you my name. Every generation, it will change. It's iterative." Mm-hmm. And I think, like you say, it's post-Churban Europe. I mean, getting extra money, making takanas for chasanas, these are wonderful things. But as a people who's standing in the shadow of losing the majority of our brothers, I think our primary obligation has to be in something that's binary, which is survival. And to me, the lamas are tikkur l'shmi mashmal today, it's not our old enemies. It's a new enemy. And keep the doors closed. Don't let them in. That would be my, but clearly, you know, I respect very much, you know, you've been around and wise, and we're fighting the same battle. We may just looking at it from different angles. We're speaking to the very esteemed Rabbi Chaim David Zwiebel, the Executive Vice President of the Venerable Agudas Yisrael of America.
I would just respond to the point you made now, which is that yes, there are new challenges, and we have to recognize each generation has its own special challenge and to confront them. And what I said before about the Federation's involvement in this, I think, may give us a little bit of an insight into one of the challenges that we face as a Jewish community today, which is so many of our brethren here in America, but really all over, are at cliff's edge, you know, and so many of them never have fallen off the cliff already in terms of any connection with Judaism and so on, which reiterates for us and should remind us not only of the importance of our own yeshiva community, which we're so familiar with and which is so precious to us, but of the day school population all across this country and the incredibly important role that the day schools play in serving as places where parents who still want to maintain a little bit of a future of Jewish identity for their families and for their children, they will send their children to these schools. If we only knew and appreciated how precious these schools are and how important they are in terms of standing there as a bulwark against the ravages of assimilation and intermarriage and all of those things that are destroying our people, we as a community would hopefully on our own come to appreciate and support these institutions and make them more vibrant. And maybe that too explains a little bit why the Gedolei Yisrael continue to feel that we have to find ways to, in a very tangible sense, to prop up these schools and to help them. And if that means reaching out to government through policies that will have a major beneficial impact, even if they might benefit other groups as well, it's something that we still need to do.
So I'd like to conclude with a little thought about this week's parsha. You know, it's the story of Bilam, and Bilam was filled with hatred. He had this passionate hatred, and you know, hatred for Am Yisrael. And Hashem comes to him and he says, "Loi seilech imoim, don't go with them." He wanted nothing more to do than to curse. He the ayin ra, to curse. He was full of anger and vitriol. So Hashem says, "Lo yiseilech imoim." When they come the next morning, he says, "You know, I can't go with you because you're not big enough." He didn't send big enough sarim. If you send bigger sarim, then I would go with you. Now God never said that. But you know, when somebody's full of passion, when they've made up their mind, they don't hear anything. They only hear what they want to hear. You know, people have very selective listening. Have you ever seen that? You know, somebody told me a story. He said a guy walks into a restaurant one day and he says, a little kid, and he says, "You know, I'm trying to do my homework. How much is 2 plus 2? So there's a guy there wiping the floor, and he says, 2 plus 2, that's 4. And there's a lady waiting in line, and she's, she works in the hospital. She delivers children. She says, 2 plus 2, that's quadruplets. And there's a physicist there, and he says, 2 plus 2, well, if you take 2 drops of water and 2 drops of water, it's 1. Becomes 1 drop of water when you're done, you know? And there's a lawyer there, and he looks at the little boy, and he says in a quiet tone, he puts his arm around him, whispers into his ear, 2 plus 2, what do you want it to be? So we really all hear the things we want to hear, right? So Hashem said to Bilam, "Loi seilech imoim, don't go curse them." I love, and he said, no, he heard, "Don't go curse them because you're not chashuv enough." But what's the message here? When we're filled with passion, we see things in just a very, you know, one-sided way. I'll tell you a very music anecdote. I heard from Dr. Pelkowitz. He said he was speaking. He announced that he was speaking in New Square, and they asked him to speak about, gender attractions, etc. So, and they put articles in their thing that he's coming in 2 weeks, so he came. And a father came over to him and told him, he said, you know, I want to tell you something. I saw you were going to speak about this, in a few weeks, and it's been on my head all day. So my little boy comes over to me around a week ago, and he says, Abba, he says, what does gay mean? So I got all upset. I said, you know, I brought up my kids in a sheltered environment. They shouldn't know what's going on in the world. And now my my six-year-old or seven-year-old comes over to me, what does gay mean? But I saw you were coming, and I know this is very relevant, and there's all kinds of issues, molestation. So I said, I'm going to just be honest with him. And I sat down, and I told him, you know, explained it to him, etc. I was just honest. I was a father. And my kid turns all red, and he looks at me, and he says, and Abba, he says, what does tzalmavis mean? So here's a little boy. He wanted to know what gay tzalmavis means, and the father, you know, because you hear what you want to hear. But what does that mean? That means when it comes, that's on the negative side. But on the positive side, when we want to do something, when we're passionate about it, Ahava Mikalkelis es Ashura, you know, Galileo said, he said, genius, the genesis of genius, the core of genius is passion. And if you look at our Parsha, it's bookended by passion, right? There are two people in our Parsha. There's Bilam, who's filled with passion. And this Pinchas, who's filled with passion, he's the Kanoi. His passion is so great, it has no Kalim. It's Kanoi vein, ein halacha vein moirin kein. I'll tell you a thing. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz said the same thing about hearing what you want to hear. He says an interesting story. The Gemara says that Ilish was captured. And Ilish spoke the language of the birds. That's what the Aruch says. And he was sitting there, and an Oriv came by, a raven, and it said, run, now's a good time to escape. So Ilish turns around to the fellow next to him, who was somebody who was a magician, who also spoke, and he said, what did he say? And he said, run. Ilish said, you know, I just don't believe ravens, they have a bad reputation. No. He knew if he tried to escape, he would be killed if he failed. Then a dove came, and the dove screeched, and Ilish turns around, and he says, what did he say? He said, Ilish, it's an appropriate time. It's to run. So he ran and he escaped. So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz said, so Reb Akiva asks, he says, this Gemara is difficult because according to the Aruch that he understood the language of birds, why did he have to ask the fellow next to him? So Reb Chaim said, no, you don't understand. Reb Chaim said, Ilish wanted nothing more in his life to hear now, escape, it's a good time to run. And when you're a Nogeya B'davar, when you want to hear something, when you hear it, you better be careful because you're probably hearing what you want to hear. So he turned around to the fellow next to him and he said, what did he say? And when he said, it's time to run, he said, okay, now I know that it's true and I'm not hearing what I want to hear. Because when we're full of passion, we just start believing, we get a bias, we just want to get that answer. Now, there's a book that came out called The Secret. Came out a few years ago. It sold 19 million copies, was translated into 30-some-odd languages. And it writes about an interesting thing. It's called the law of attraction. And what does the law of attraction mean? He says that when a person wants something, nature itself sort of cooperates, brings that, makes that, helps you. It's like jumping into the stream. And people read it and they said, wow, it's like wacko. It's like, But it sold 19 million copies. And it was about really believing whatever your mission is in life, whatever your job is, whatever your whatever you want to do, really become passionate about it. So he said, because the world itself, but I think it's really all Yiddishkeit, it's Eisgehalten. And let me tell you a story. The Medrash says in Shmini, on the Pasuk of Yayin V'Shecher Al Tesht, there was a family, their father was a drunkard. And they tried everything, intervention, they brought the biggest psychologist, it didn't help. So they took him and they stuck him in the cemetery. And they thought that he would be spooked and he would wake up and see he's in a cemetery and realize the dangers of drinking. But what happened? A caravan was going to the town of wine merchants, and they heard an army coming, and they said, oh, no, armies, a bunch of soldiers, they're all going to get drunk, they're going to steal our wine. So they stuck all these barrels into the cemetery to hide from the army. This drunk wakes up, and he's surrounded by 100 barrels of fantastic wine. So 3 days later, the kid said, look, you know, we better go visit Papa. He's going to starve to death. I mean, we spooked him enough. It's enough. It's enough. It's enough. So they come there, and the Medrash says, and they find their father in bliss sleeping with the nozzle of this huge barrel of wine dripping into his mouth. Right? Humorous story, but it's really the story of the secret. When you really want something and you're passionate about it and you believe in it, it happens. But what happens in life? We get frustrated. We get distracted. It's a boss, it's a job, it's a spouse, it's children, it's called life, the IRS, taxes, I mean, you name it. We get distracted. And sometimes we look at ourselves and we say, am I really that person who I was X number of years ago that really was so passionate? Bilam never lost his passion. He still hated. But the parsha's bookend, that Pinchas was also passionate. He was a kind of, he really believed. And he stayed passionate his whole life. He was the Kanoi. And what happened? How was Pinchas rewarded? Pinchas becomes Eliyahu. He never dies. He becomes Elijah. By every bris, who shows up? We were speaking about bris today, about Matzitza. Pinchas comes. Eliyahu comes. If a person is passionate, they're forever young. A child is passionate. When we get older, we get cynical, we get frustrated, we forget. But the message of Pinchas, the message even of Bilam, the Gemara says we can learn from Bilam, is awaken, reawaken that passion. You want to be a genius, you want to be great at what you do, you want to follow Galileo's advice, the genesis of genius is passion. Reawaken that passion. So, whatever you want to do in life, you want to lose weight, you want to make money, you want to be a Goyen, spend less time on tactics and spend more time in Ta'iru Vim Ta'iru Esahava Chatechbats. Spend more time on awakening that passion. If we can rekindle passion, we can find genius. If we can kindle that burning Ratzin comes even before Das, before Chachma, we can accomplish great things. Thank you so much. I look forward to speaking to you next week. This is David Lichtenstein, Headlines Radio.